new hour on the alternative media. I am your host, Patrick Slattery. We are here with attorney Don Advo, who has been so kind to come back again. Don, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks so much for inviting me back. It's always great to appear with Dr. Patrick Slattery.
Well, it's always great to have you here. And if we have a show that's half as good as the conversation that we had earlier today, it's going to be a real treat for everyone. There's a lot to talk about. I wanted, just before the break, when I was talking to Benjamin Fulford, I had mentioned something about the possibility of Electoral College shenanigans. Not convention, but Electoral College. And I just want to get into that a little bit first, and then we'll go into some of these other issues. But, you know, people have been talking a lot about the delegate selection process for the Republican convention, how a lot of the delegates who are supposedly going there to represent Donald Trump are people who don't particularly like Donald Trump. And in many cases, they may be bound to vote for him on the first ballot, but if it goes beyond a first ballot, then they're going to desert him. And, you know, so these are real issues, real problems. I still have the feeling that he's going to win so many delegates and that the RNC and his various rivals will probably, it's not for sure, but they'll probably say, okay, we're not going to create the chaos here. We'll, if they're opposed to Donald Trump, they'll try to draw their defense line somewhere else. And one last line of defense for people who would not want a Donald Trump presidency would be the Electoral College. And Don, I know you're familiar with the Constitution, and the unlike the conventions, which have, you know, political parties and conventions have, you know, there's not a word about them in the Constitution. But the Electoral College was spelled out in the Constitution. Was spelled out twice, actually. It was spelled out in the original Constitution, the Articles. I guess, is it Article 2 that talks about the presidency?
I believe it is, yeah.
Right. And then the, I think it's the 12th Amendment, where they had to redo the Electoral College because it just didn't work out the way they thought it was. That, you know, with the resulting Aaron Burr, Thomas Jefferson tie in the 1800 election. So they changed it. But here's the issue that we're facing for this year. Who are the electors who vote in the Electoral College? And the way they are selected varies from state to state. Now, typically, we've grown to expect that the popular vote winner in any state is going to win the electoral votes of that state. We've come to think of it as just kind of being an automatic. But it's not an automatic. Actually, there are individuals who become electors. And how are those individuals selected? And it does vary from state to state, but one typical way is at these, in the states that have these congressional district and statewide conventions for their party, and there's been a little bit of attention given to them lately because, they're selecting delegates to the RNC at these conventions. Another thing they do is they select a slate of electors for the Electoral College who would be elected as electors if that slate attached to the candidate wins. I have the experience of almost 30 years ago having my name placed in nomination at a congressional district convention to be the elector from that congressional district for the Democrats. I was in the Democratic Party at that time. I took my name out of nomination. I simply wanted to use my two-minute nomination speech to warn about the dangers of the Electoral College, and that's what I'm doing again. Here's the thing. The electors who are being selected at the these various Republican conventions, statewide or congressional district, they're typically going to be party functionaries, party establishment people who are being rewarded for, you know, years of service to the party or something like that. They're establishment people, and a lot of them are very much against Trump. Now, if Trump becomes the nominee and he wins, if he wins Arizona, if he wins Kansas, if he wins these states, the electors who are on the Republican slate of electors that was, you know, proposed by the Republican Party and certified by the state secretaries of state, they will become electors. And then in mid-December, I believe it's December 15th, they cast their votes in their respective states. Those votes get sent to Congress, and they get opened up by the new Congress in January and counted. And in about half the states, there aren't even rules that these state that the electors have to vote for the candidate that they were pledged to. In half the in the other half of the states, there are rules or state laws. But in most cases, there's no real enforcement. There are a few states where there is enforcement. If they don't vote the way they were pledged to vote, then their vote is nullified and a new elector is appointed. But that's a small minority of the states that have those laws. So what you have, and I'm sorry to be going on so long on this, but what you have is a system where individual electors can just decide they're not going to vote the way they had pledged to. And this has happened many times in the past. You've had it in the 2000 election. You had an elector from D.C. who decided I think it was a she, and she didn't like the fact that D.C. doesn't have representation in Congress, and so she just refused to cast her vote. It would have been a Gore vote. And, you know, that was a pretty close election. It wasn't decisive, but it was a pretty close election. It could have been decisive if some other people had done the same type of thing. You've had in other elections, I know in the 72 election, one of the one of the electors from North Carolina who was supposed to vote for Nixon voted for Wallace. So you have this type of thing. There have been in the course of our history, over 150 electoral votes cast that were not for the candidate that the elector had pledged to vote for. So it's happened. Okay, so what's the punchline? If we have an election that's relatively close, like 2000 or even 2004, let's just say the 2000 election where Bush won 271 electoral votes, and he needed 270. If you had Donald Trump winning 271 electoral votes, all it would take would be for two electors that were pledged to vote for him not to vote for him. Then no candidate would have a majority. And in January, the House of Representatives would select from the top three electoral vote getters. So let's just say you had two people, two electors who are pledged to Trump, but they vote for Paul Ryan. Then in January, the House of Representatives would have to choose between presumably Hillary, Trump, and Paul Ryan. And is there not a possibility that these House of Representatives Republicans would vote for Paul Ryan over Trump? And remember, you would have repeated ballots until somebody gets a majority. So that's – and if let's just say the election wasn't – as close as 2000, let's just say it was more like 2004. Well, maybe it would take a couple of dozen electors to defect, but that's all it would take. It wouldn't take a majority of Republican electors to defect, just enough so that Trump would be deprived of a majority of votes, and then it would go to the House of Representatives. This is something that's really possible. It might seem far-fetched to a lot of people. What do you think about that, Don? Am I thinking just too hard?
No, you're not thinking too hard. A lot of the conservative talk radio Judeo-cons have talked about that.
I hope I'm not giving them ideas.
Well, no, they talked about it at some length. Michael Medved has talked a lot about it. You can tell he's racking his brain at some way to destroy the Trump presidency. Mark Levin, I think, has talked about it. Those are the two main ones. But Michael Medved has really got Trump derangement syndrome. He spends at least one of his 3 hours on the radio every day denouncing Trump and going after Trump in so many different ways. And some of it is really very juvenile. I have to say, I used to kind of enjoy Medved. He's a very bright guy, very entertaining. And then I read his memoir, and I became Jew-wise, and certain things that would have flown right by me kind of jumped out at me. And I read his memoir, and I listened to what he says, and he's becoming increasingly Judaistic in his, he's especially rabid on the illegal immigration issue. He wants this country flooded with as many non-whites as we can get in.
And what's his rationale for that?
His rationale is they are here, and it is wrong to kick them out, and it will turn the Hispanics on the Republican Party, and we need to be more inclusive, and it's just platitudes. It's obvious treason, and knowing who he is and what he is, it is obvious to me. He's just another Jew who wants to see white people wiped out. That's all he is. And the way that he became very prominent, The astonishing thing about Michael Medved, it's right there in his memoir. I'm not talking about anything that is the slightest bit controversial. He was very liberal. He went to Yale undergraduate on a National Merit Scholarship, and he majored in American history, and he was very liberal. He worked for Bobby Kennedy, and then at some point in time, he went on ride-alongs with the police in Berkeley, California, and he realized what great guys the police were. And he saw that conservatism worked and liberalism didn't, and so he turned right, hence the title of his memoir, Right Turns. There's one part of it. He's a host on the Salem Radio Network, which is the largest Christian radio network in the world. Seems like most of its hosts are Jewish, but it nevertheless calls itself a Christian radio network. And the story of how he got there is just absolutely astonishing. He lays it all out in his memoir, and he's talked about it on the air many times. He talks about how he brought home a Christian Catholic white girl, a fiancé from Yale, I guess it was in Connecticut. And the family, his Jewish family, basically gave her the cold shoulder, and his father told him, and his uncle told him, look, if you marry this girl, we will disown you, we will disown your children, you will be contributing to the end of your people. You know, we go back 3,000 years, and you'll break the straight line. And so he had a very, very awkward visit with his family with this girl, and he tells about how he kind of holed up in his room, and he read books about his Jewish heritage and his Jewish tradition and history, and he read all these books, and then he became a committed Jew, and he worked to establish a Jewish community, I think in Santa Monica, like an Orthodox Jewish community, and talked about how they bought apartment buildings and they converted into condominiums so that Jewish members of the congregation could buy them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, isn't it interesting how flagrant these people are in the complete denial of every other law that applies to the rest of us? This is a guy who strongly supports civil rights laws, but he violated probably half a dozen of them when he discriminated against everybody else except his own congregation in the sale of residential housing. You know, we had a huge battle over that in California many years ago before the Fair Housing Act of 1968 was passed at the federal level. But in any event, they don't even feel the need to conceal their contempt for the law and their violation of the law. And then his career was that of a movie reviewer. And he reviewed a couple of movies that were very critical of Christians, and he was very sympathetic to Christians, and he got all these speech invitations from Christian colleges all over the country to come and speak. And so he basically developed a following in that manner. He said a few nice things about Christians, and they kind of flocked to him. It's almost like the Stockholm Syndrome kind of a thing. And he flocked to him as kind of a protector in Salem. He sat in for Rush Limbaugh a couple of times on Limbaugh's show, and he felt that he had kind of a talent for talk radio, and then he started his own show in, I think, Seattle. Became very successful, and then he got signed on and syndicated with Salem. So it is so astonishing to me that this Jew who expresses his open contempt of Christians and Christianity is pounced upon by these Christians and sought after by Christians as kind of a protector, you know, like a capo in a prison or something, or a trustee. It's a very weird psychological thing there. And in his book, he talked about Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ. And he saw the film. He thought it was good. And, you know, a lot of these Jewish groups were trying to shut down the film. They thought it would inflame anti-Semites and give rise to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And he said no, he didn't believe that. And he called Abe Foxman, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, one of the preeminent Jewish spy organizations, the goal of which is to suppress free speech and get people fired from their jobs, notwithstanding that they call themselves a civil rights organization. Mm-hmm. Something really weirdly Orwellian about that. But he says, Abe, he says, this film is good for the Jews. And I thought to myself, isn't that an interesting thing? Isn't that an interesting rationale? I mean, why not just say, hey, Abe, free speech belongs to everybody, including Christians? That's not what he said.
He said, now, what was his rationale for thinking it was good for the Jews?
What was his rationale?
Yeah, and I have to say, I never saw the film.
I never saw it either, but I guess it's just basically a traditional kind of New Testament account of the crucifixion and the conflict between Jesus and
the
Sanhedrin.
John, as I understand.
Yeah, whatever. I don't know which one. I watched a little bit of it when it was on cable. It was pretty bloody, and I said, sorry, this is not my thing. But, I mean, it's just pretty traditional. I mean, you've got an upstart who is challenging the leadership of some powerful institution, in this case, a church. I mean, who really cares about that stuff anyway, except, you know, evangelicals and scholars and people like that. It's not like, you know, Joe Lunchbucket is going to turn off Monday Night Football and see Passion of the Christ and go out and vandalize the synagogue or anything. I mean, you know, who cares? But in any event, that was his argument. You hear this argument with these Jews in talk radio. Dennis Prager is another one. And they're on the same network, and they know each other very well, Prager and Medved. And he said, oh, Christian America is good for Jews. A good, strong Christian America is good for Jews. And so...
Now, I thought it was some sort of anti-Semitic canard that Jewish people were concerned about what's good for the Jews.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. But
I don't think so either. I mean, they have their own private country. They have their own kind of like invisible government. They have their own... their own institutions. They have this whole network of Jewish charities. They have the kosher tax, whereby they regulate the food industry based on Jewish dietary laws that go back 3,000 years before we knew anything about germ theory or bacteria theory, or before we invented the microscope, before we had very much modern scientific knowledge about anything. So thank God they don't control the pharmaceutical industry. What state would we be if our really important industries were controlled by people whose worldview derives from ancient laws promulgated 3,000 years ago,
well,
when science was still in its infancy?
There is a medical section of which book is it? I can't remember which book it is, but it talks about how to deal with leprosy, and it's worthy of note that 3,000 years later, we still have leprosy with us.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, that is our break music. We will be back after the break with more with Attorney Don Advo. Okay, we are back. We're back. One of these days, I'm going to let that song play long enough so that we can hear about Liberace and all his curly hair, all his wavy hair. That's one of the lines from the song. I did not know that those were the original lyrics. I thought it was an older song from the pre-Liberace days. But no, it's from a time when, I guess when women could still sing about Liberace as a romantic figure and be plausible.
Okay. Is that right?
Yeah, it's from, I think, 1954. And Liberace was out, and well, he wasn't out of the closet, but he was out performing in public. He was an outstanding piano player. I'll give him that. So we were going to talk about narratives, and you know, we have kind of a hegemony of these Jewish narratives. You know, like there's no such thing as race. And our strength is our diversity, and a whole bunch. And Don, I believe you prepared a list of narratives that are challenging for us.
Well, I did. I studied the whole. It really goes back to my my awakening to the whole white nationalist racial Jewish power problem, which occurred for me in the year 2000 when I attended a revisionist history conference in Southern California, and it was attended by David Irving and Robert Farazan and Guillermo Rudolph, Ingrid Rimland, Ernest Zundel, and a number of other people who were involved in revisionist history of World War II, much of which was, you know, Holocaust revisionism. It was sponsored by the Institute for Historical Review, and I was stunned to find out that, you know, half a century after my father had been drafted to go and fight and restore freedom to Europe and make the world safer democracy, people in Europe were being thrown in jail by Jews for disagreeing with the official Jewish version of the history of World War II. That seemed kind of weird to me that we fought a war for all these civil rights. And I kind of butted, hit headlong into the aura of Jewish power. And a bunch of people started talking to me about Jewish power, and not only in connection with free speech and the Holocaust, but also the kosher tax. I read a little pamphlet about that, and I was quite stunned to see that. And then I started studying Jewish power, much of it through the prism of court cases, some of which dealt with the separation of church and state, some of which dealt with the kosher tax and free speech issues and other things. And it's obvious that there are certain narratives which are very, very difficult. Probably the most difficult is any kind of criticism of Jewish power in Judaism. There's really not, I mean, that's really, I think the most difficult.
And yet, as Gilad Otman says, the prohibition, the ability to stifle discussion of Jewish power is the essence of Jewish power.
Well, stifle discussion is the essence of Jewish power is the essence of Jewish power. You couldn't be more correct. And I studied, I became aware of the racial war of dispossession and extermination that is being practiced against white people. And I really started reading a lot of federal court decisions on various civil rights laws and studying the history of the Civil Rights Act, the 13th Amendment, and certain constitutional amendments, and looking at them very, very carefully. And it occurred to me that we're dealing with kind of cycles in history, and one of the great event in American history in the 1800s was the Civil War, which overturned a particular form of a slave regime in the 1800s and he tried to come to grips with the issue of a mixed race society, a diverse society, as we would call it. And then it struck me that even as though slavery was ended in the 1800s, the so-called civil rights movement, the purpose of the civil rights movement, the effect of the civil rights movement was to reinstitute a new form of slavery into the United States, this time with white people as the legally subordinate race, and just about everybody else as the legally superior race. I was interested to find out that they wanted to start passing group libel laws in the aftermath of World War II. Norman Cousins, the very famous editor, I think it was Saturday Review, wrote an op-ed about we need to have group libel so that when groups are talked about badly, there can be lawsuits. Like if you say something bad about Jewish bankers or, you know, quote the black crime rates.
I'm hearing Hank Williams. He's telling us that we're off for another break. But we will be back with Attorney Don Advo after this break.
Just stood there and never let it show, so she could never answer yes or no.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
This is the Alternative Media. I am your host for the time being, Patrick Slattery. We're here with Don Advo. And you were saying before the break, you were starting to talk about, I think you, before the break, we were just getting to the institution of slavery and freedom of association. So do you want to sedate on that?
Well, sure. The essence of slavery is a targeted person being stripped of his or her rights of freedom of association. That's the whole essence of slavery. You throw a net over somebody and force them to live on a plantation and pick cotton or hoe tobacco or whatever. Of course, many rights are implicated in that, but the primary right is the right of freedom of association. And, that was the moral root of slavery. And if you look at the whole civil rights agenda, the misnamed Orwellian civil rights agenda, the whole purpose of it, from Brown versus the Board of Education to the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Fair Housing Act of 68, all of these laws are, including this bathroom thing, you know, it is stripping women of the right to freedom of association, to associate only with women in the bathroom and not to have creeps come in and violate their privacy. The whole stripping of the right of freedom of association is stripping a group of people of the right to discriminate and make rational choices to protect their interests, to protect themselves and their families from being harmed by dangerous associations with predators and creeps and various kinds of harmful life forms. We go back to, and if you look at the way that the civil rights movement is simply the flip side of slavery, it is simply to impose upon, to strip white people of their rights by stripping them of their right of free association, by stripping them of the right to live, to have their own neighborhood, to have their own schools, to have their own institutions, their own businesses, their own churches. You know, there was a little church in the Midwest that didn't want to perform interracial marriages, and they were pounced on and treated very harshly. So in order to have an effective pro-white narrative, I think you first have to realize what it is you're fighting against, what you're narrating against, and you have to develop moral and intellectual clarity about what is being done to us.
Okay, I have a question.
Sure.
Regarding Brown versus the Board of Education, and I'm not right. I haven't read the decision, and even if I did read it, I wouldn't have the insights you do because I don't have the legal background. But What is it about that decision? Is there some sort of asymmetry? Is it why is it that a broad question was, why is it that this is enslaving white children? How is it taking away white freedom of association, or is it treating whites differently from blacks, or isn't it just all, you know, everybody has the same rights? Can you explain that?
Happy to. And it's not really a freedom of association case, because you're dealing with school children, and you know, children really don't have civil rights. They do what adults tell them to. They do what their parents tell them to. And to speak of Brown in the context of a right of freedom of association is a little misleading. What Brown versus the Board of Education said was that black people have property rights in captive white children.
Okay, and how does it say that?
Let me finish. Brown, 100 years after the, well, less than 100 years after the Civil War, in the Brown case, the United States Supreme Court created a legally enforceable possessory interest in human beings, the effect of which was to require public schools to maintain inventories of captive white children to be distributed for the purposes of achieving forced racial integration. I'll read one sentence of the Brown decision, which summarizes everything. This is a quote from the Brown decision. Quote, "We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does." Okay? Now, bear in mind, when anybody says Brown versus the Board of Education, people say, oh, the 14th Amendment, equal education, equal rights. Okay, Brown doesn't say black children have a right to an equal education or even a good education. It says the separation of minority children from white children denies the minority child an educational opportunity. It is the physical presence in the classroom, the compelled physical presence, if necessary, that provides a quote-unquote educational opportunity. Remember, it is not white schools. There's no such thing as a white school. You know, it's not like, oh, we want to go to the white schoolhouse because it's painted white. We want to be with white children. And if they built a separate building for white children, that would violate the right of the minorities because the white children ran away. It is the compelled physical presence, i.e. captive white children. Mm-hmm. And that is the sense that says it. Does segregation of the children deprive children, a minority group, of an equal educational opportunity? We believe that it does. And this was okay. The basis of all these cases of forced racial immigration, you know, forced busing, you know, going out and hunting down white children in adjacent communities if necessary and busing them in. Forced busing in of white children is morally indistinguishable from putting blacks in a wagon and taking them out to the fields to pick cotton.
Okay.
It is
a physical
interest in people.
Okay, I want to get back. You had read from that decision, and the sentence before the one that you just repeated, it said something about it's not sufficient for the schools to be of what was that sentence?
Okay, we come to the question presented, and this is very significant because when a court says that, it's identifying the specific legal issue. Okay, does the segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal?
Okay, even though physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal. And so basically it's saying even though, you know, 14th Amendment, equal rights, even though they might be equal, still, there is some compelling reason why the presence of the majority population children have to be there. Otherwise, the minority child is being deprived of an opportunity. Is that it?
Okay. That's correct. It is the presence of the white child.
So it's not the equality of the facilities. It's not the equality of the teachers. It's not that quality or equality.
Right.
It comes down to having the presence of the majority. Well, what happens? How about this? California, the white children are not a majority.
Not anymore. No.
I mean, I don't suppose there's been any legal challenge to this, but what about that? I don't know.
Well, what do you mean, a challenge? For what purpose?
I don't suppose there's really been a whole lot of challenges to Brown versus the Board of Education per se. It's been laid down the Supreme Court.
In the years that followed, there were quite a few challenges actually.
Now, how about like in Boston? I remember in the early 70s in Boston, I guess South Boston, which was the Irish neighborhood, and there was busing in Boston, forced busing in Boston, but was it across municipal lines, or across school district lines, or was it just simply that it was in the north and not in the south that made it a big deal?
Well, my understanding is they took them from the south end of Boston and took them to the north end, or vice versa. I mean, the point is they bused children back and forth. It was based on the Brown decision, and it was based on the premise that blacks have a right to force unwilling white children to sit next to them physically in a classroom. It is a legally enforceable possessory interest in people. Okay.
And you mentioned there have been challenges. What types of challenges have there been to that decision?
Well, in Virginia, one school district just shut down the public schools.
Right.
Several decades.
That was in the 1960s. That was I wanted to say Harry Flood Byrd, but he was a senator. The governor shut it down.
The big challenge was that white people ran away. Okay, when slaves ran away in the old South, they were called fugitive slaves. Today, they're not really called fugitive white people, but it's called white flight. Do you see the historical parallel there?
So you have the white flight, and then moving into different school districts. But
yeah, and they move out, and then in Detroit, Michigan, they try to cast a net over the suburban districts because they said, look, you know, we don't have enough white children in Detroit to achieve forced racial integration, so we have to go to the outlying districts. You know, it's like slave hunters going further into the interior of the continent of Africa looking for captive bodies. And if you read these decisions, I mean, they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible. And I don't understand why so few lawyers, so few professional people see what the real meaning here is. They get all hung up on this equal protection in the 14th Amendment. Look, it created a legally enforceable possessory interest in human beings. Just like when you have a pink slip on your car, give it to a finance company. You don't make the payments, they come get the car. Okay? That's a car. There's no other area of the law which permits possessory interests in people other than, you know, custody of children or putting people in institutions for crimes or, you know, people that are mentally ill and have to be institutionalized. You cannot pledge yourself as collateral for a loan. It violates public policy. We don't put people in jail for failure to pay to pay money. This is the most unusual thing in modern American jurisprudence, the vesting in black people of property rights in white children. And it forces the school districts to keep inventories of captive white children. And school districts get sued if they don't have enough white children. And then you have this thing where they're trying to cast their net out into the white suburbs. Now, it admittedly, urban forced racial integration has largely failed because they just kind of ran out of gas. There was so much popular opposition to it, even though the law is still very much in force. In fact, there's not really a whole lot of of popular support for busing kids back and forth. It was a huge hardship for all kids, and I think it just kind of ran out of gas, but you still have white people running away. Today, it is the white people who are the fugitive slaves, whereas under the old slavery, it was the black people who were the fugitive slaves. And if we are ever going to get our people motivated to fight back, I believe we need a comprehensive, unified theory of white advocacy. And people have to feel like they have the moral high ground. They need to feel it. They need to understand it. They need to achieve moral and intellectual clarity. And what is the basis for opposing Brown versus the Board of Education? Not because you are opposed to equality, you know, whatever that means, but because you are opposed to an evil legal doctrine that transforms human beings into a kind of property. Mm-hmm. What do you think the soldiers with fixed bayonets in 1957 in Little Rock, Arkansas were about? It was to force unwilling white children against their will into classes with black children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're saying to the black children, you have a constitutional right to force an unwilling white child to sit here, and we're going to send out troops with fixed bayonets and rifles to enforce that right.
Mm-hmm.
And until and unless our people really understand what has been done to them, they will not have the moral confidence to fight back. People who do not believe they hold a moral high ground won't fight.
Right.
And that's one of the things that has so debilitated our people in the last half century.
Okay, now you've been talking about, you've been making legal arguments, you've been making, you know, moral arguments, and I don't dispute them. I'm a policy researcher myself, and so aside from the moral issues and aside from the legal issues, I look at the results of this policy. And if you study the results of the policy, the idea of putting all the children, you know, forcing children from different communities and from different racial groups even into the same schools. What is the educational outcome? And for instance, there have been studies on differences in behavior between children of different races and in the classroom and in under what circumstances do they learn better? And for instance, black boys tend to learn better when they are moving around, that they have much more difficulty sitting still at a desk than whites or Asians. Yet if they're allowed to stand up and move around some, they can learn better. But of course, if they're standing up and moving around in a room full of, white kids who are sitting still, that becomes a disruption. And so, in terms of education, so forget it, I'm right now I'm not addressing the legal or moral arguments, just strictly educational argument. Who is being helped by putting two different populations into a single classroom when they learn better in different types of environments, if that's the case, and that does seem to be what research indicates?
Well, I know integrated schools have been a disaster. I don't know anybody who's gone into one and said it was a great experience. I mean, you have people like Howard Stern talked about he got beaten up every day. I had family members who had to go to integrated schools, and my sister couldn't use the bathroom there because she'd be beaten up by black girls.
I've heard hundreds of thousands of
these stories over the years. And, you know, frankly, I don't care about the educational outcome. I don't care about it. That's like saying, well, gee, you know, I'm that's like the Southern slave owner defending slavery because it was very profitable. I made a lot of money. I don't care if it has good outcomes or bad outcomes. I am against slavery. I am against property rights in people.
Yeah. Now we're talking about white narratives, for instance, and who you're speaking to, depending on who you are speaking to, different narratives, different arguments are going to be more effective. Okay, we'll be back after the break. We'll be right back. welcome back to this next segment. We still have an hour to go after the break, but we're here with Attorney Don Advocate. We've been talking about, up until now, the Brown versus the Board of Education, but we're going to be talking about the Civil Rights Act and Martin Luther King and other narratives that are, I mean, all of these, whether it's the Brown versus the Board of Education, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Martin Luther King and his holiday and his dream and his memory, these are all part of a kind of a hegemonic culture or weaponization of culture, weaponization of history that's used pretty effectively against the white majority in this country. It's part of this overall drive to demoralize us, and so that we'll be willing to accept our own, I would say, slow but steady demise. It's not even all that slow, but you know, this steady demise. So, moving on, isn't the Civil Rights Act just equality, and isn't that great for everybody? And Martin Luther King, I mean, his dream and his ideas, they were heroic, weren't they?
No, they weren't heroic. They were despicable and contemptible and base and ignoble.
I've never heard that on TV. So how can that be?
Martin Luther King openly advocated the creation of a racial caste system in the United States. And the bottom, people on the bottom would be white people as a debtor race.
Okay, and so
the
explain
people
to
on the
that,
top
how,
would be black
that
people as
that?
A creditor race. I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. And so what was it that he said that would lead one to that conclusion?
Okay, let me just quote a brief quotation here. I think it was, his book, Why We Can't Wait. I think that was it. But he made these same statements in a Playboy interview. He made them repeatedly. This is a quotation from his famous book. Let me make sure I get it correct. It's Why We Can't Wait. Okay, he says this, quote, "No amount of gold could provide an adequate compensation for the exploitation and humiliation of the Negro in America down through the centuries. Not all the wealth of this affluent society could meet the bill. Yet a price can be placed on unpaid wages. The ancient common law has always provided a remedy for the appropriation of the labor of one human being by another. This law should be made applicable to American Negroes. The payment should be in the form of a massive program of special compensatory measures, which could be regarded as a settlement in accordance with the accepted practice of the common law. Such measures would certainly be less expensive than any compensation based on two centuries of unpaid wages and accumulated interest." Okay, you see what he's saying here? No amount of gold could provide adequate compensation for the Negro in America. So the blacks, are the Negroes, as he called them, are elevated to a legal status as a creditor race to whom a debt is owed. White people are lowered to the status of a subordinate debtor race. Millions of white people who never owned slaves are going to pay a debt to millions of black people who never were slaves. And this is
I am hearing some music coming up, but we do have one more hour, and so we are going to delve into this and maybe take a few calls too. So we'll be back at the top of the hour with Attorney Don Adlow on the Alternative Media.